I'm excited about AI is I feel it can raise the productivity, eliminate the waste, give cycle for people to change versus crunching, take the human factor of mistake out of a lot of things. But it will never replace a team motivated that can adapt, can do things. Because for me, look, AI is a little bit like a VCR. It swallow all the data of the past, it can do trends, but if it's faced to something they never seen, the model don't adapt. But I embrace it.
Hey, welcome back to the show. And today we're talking to an exited founder who's done some amazing things. Michel, will you tell us who you are and what you do?
Yeah, so my name is Michel Langlois. I'm an exec in Silicon Valley. I've been focused on managing software teams since I've been a professional in the business.
I love it.
And I've joined three companies that to some extent build a commercial internet. And Cisco for the enterprise, and Juniper for service provider, and Calix for broadband. That was my domain. And finally, I can explain to my kid what I'm doing is relevant to them.
I know that.
Because if they lose the internet, they're like, Patty. So
it's crazy when you get in those industries and you're hyper niched into some really specialized things and nobody has a clue what you do.
Nobody has a clue, but everybody knows an SSID now. It's amazing for me. It's like, okay.
Right. No, that's amazing. So in the industry, I mean, for the past 30 years, you literally come from, you know, the dot-com era into where it's evolutionized into what we are today, which is a very different game than when we started. Talk to us about the last company you were with, how you built it. What did you kind of do in that growth journey? What was your business? How has it evolved over the years?
So the last company was called Calix Inc. The founder essentially idea was to say, one day I will connect every home and device to the content which is in the cloud. That's easy to say. And he said, I'm not going to do it with copper or legacy technology. I'll do it with fiber because he was a fiber guy that sold his company to Cisco.
And makes sense.
The funny thing is 20 years ago, if you go as a business model to say, I'm going to build disruption in the market where there's no demand for that speed, the cost prohibitive, the complexity of deploying in fiber 20 years ago was crazy.
Yeah.
And if
yeah.
that's my business model, I'm the largest investor, and I'm going to prove everybody they were wrong. And it doesn't matter if it takes a decade, I will get it right.
Right.
And when I joined this, the value proposition was still the same, but there was change of technology that forced us to adapt this company.
Right.
First, there was like the user experience in broadband was terrible. I mean, I'm sure you have your days where you're like, hello, is this thing working? Yes and no. So the end user were not satisfied. The service provider were just trying to sell a pipe. If you talk to them, they say, how much bandwidth you want? And if you're an end user, you're like, what? What is bandwidth? I just want this thing to be up.
Right.
And with quality, so I can do streaming, work live, and balance. So there was not really focus on the end user. But I think the big change we made is we saw also disruption in the cloud coming.
Yeah.
The needs to become more like a software company than a hardware vendor. The commodity of the hardware, where everything is going to look the same. I mean, I give you a test. If I say Wi-Fi 7, you Google that on the retail, you're going to get 100 of that. How do you price for value in a model like that? So we went back into the fundamental. It's all about service and experience through software. But the company wasn't geared for that.
Yeah.
We have to, and that's the kind of thing sometimes I talk about those big ideas where if you reinvent a public company, by the way.
Right.
You're not talking about you hide in a startup for 3 years, you come back with the new shiny object.
Yeah.
How do you reinvent something where you have a brand association, but you're going to completely change the way we sell the product we build, the way we interface with customer, and to some extent, trying to teach your service provider, which is your primary channel, that if they don't change, they're going to die. So that was the thing. That was really fun. But in the journey, what you learn is, look, first, do you have the skill to do it? And it's a tough thing. I mean, you have people that have been working for 10, 15 years, 20 years with the founder.
Yeah.
Great people. But you look at the skill you're going to need for the end state of the solution. You're like, wow, I'm going to have to do change there.
Yeah.
And in one way, it's almost easier if you're coming from outside because you're not emotional, if you want. You're just looking into, I need those. Look, I have young kids. Do I have all the Legos I need to assemble this thing?
Sure.
And if I'm missing Legos, I have to decide, can I attract the people to become my Legos? Or do I partner with somebody to do it?
Yeah. Yeah.
We had no money in the bank, really, so we couldn't buy company. So we have to figure out the path. So that was the story. And the story turned out to be really good. After 7-8 years, we completely changed the market. We became market dominant. We had the succession of the founder to a new CEO that was brought 5-6 years before. So there was continuity. And now it's on them. It's on them to reach the next summit.
I love it. I love it. So that, well, that's an exciting journey. And I think that every startup dreams of that being their journey. And so how long did that take for you guys to reach that point where you were like, okay, we kind of climbed over the crest of this mountain and it's time to hand it off?
Well, it took us three things. We didn't have the technology of the cloud as a platform.
Right.
So we built it. We felt that the network was a little bit like a dump pipe. And I wanted to bring intelligence in that thing from borrowing from switching and routing, because that's where I was before, and say, why don't we bring it there? That's going to reduce the cost, and you're going to be able to do new things. Kind of nothing to lose in one way.
Yeah.
And then the third was we didn't trust any of the home gateway, so we have to build it as a platform, not just a connectivity thing. So it took us literally 7 years. And in the process, we managed to win the business of Verizon.
That's a big deal.
So you go from selling to a small operator in rural America to national level of scale. And that gave us, to some extent, a brand recognition. But with the burden now we're dealing with a portfolio of customers that are completely different.
They don't speak
the same language. Yeah. They don't think that the business the same way. So there was a lot of change, but it took 7 years. It took us literally over that cycle, 3 years to completely shift the revenue from the old into the new. 95% went into the new offering. So you can imagine if you're a customer, you're used to something, you're like, what's happening with those guys? They're changing too much. They speak a new language. Their go-to-market is aggressive. They talk about data, they talk about insight, they talk about real time. My God.
Right.
But I think you stick to it. And if I have one advice to the startup, don't change your end game, which is your ultimate plan. Adapt it or pivot if you need to. I'll give you an example. When we were there like 4 years ago, we didn't anticipate that there would be tariff. There would be supply chain problem. So we have to, oh my God, we're 100% in China. At the time, 6 years ago, if we don't do anything, we can get the supply that the Cisco, the Nokia, they will buy every supply and we will be left with a crumb.
Yeah,
so we have to learn to pivot like that and just hope that you get it right.
You know, like a
startup, we don't have any safety net.
Right, but I'm glad you brought that up. I was literally having a debate yesterday with a friend of mine who does a lot of importing from Asia, and he was just shaking his head and raising his fist saying, oh, these tariffs are killing my industry. And I said, you know, I had the same argument of like, we've been talking about this for a long time
that
China would be tariff. Like, why didn't you start moving 6 years ago, you know, let alone this month, you know? So I think that there's a lot to be said there, but your insight or your foresight into seeing what would be coming down the pipeline, I compliment you for that. And what kind of challenge was that? Because that sounds like a real pain in the butt. If you're 100% in China and now all of a sudden you're trying to diversify where you're getting product from, what did that whole journey look like? And would you credit that to your ability to sustain the growth you wanted to do over the last 6 years?
I think what we had is we brought few leaders that had done global scale of manufacturing. So sometimes, I mean, my advice is what looks new to a company, a certain side, sometimes it's deja vu for the others.
Yeah.
So the challenge, if you mix the blood with people that have seen bigger, different story, they come with a perspective first to say, could be done. Or they also tell you, don't go that path. The changes that you feel are pretty high.
Right.
So look, what did we do? Look, the first instinct we had was to say, why don't we go to Taiwan? And then we start thinking about it like things get ugly. It's not going to get well there too.
Yeah, so that could be a bad. and
we start to look into, wait a minute, there's people with a lot more volume than us. You know, the Google or everybody else. Or where are they? And then we start to realize, oh, they land in Vietnam. They land in Thailand. They land in this. They have a hub there.
Yeah.
Mexico can be used.
Yeah.
And then once you connect the dot and you have the focus to say, we're going to have to go there. In fact, we did execute that thing fairly smooth in perspective. But we have to explain a lot more what's happening to the customer because they couldn't understand why we were doing this.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, because they've never seen it.
They've never seen it, but it's a beautiful thing that you recognize it as early as you did and that you started making changes. You know, you've now exited the company and you're now kind of transitioning your mind into how can I teach what I've learned to the world? I'm guessing this is kind of the stage of mindset you're in, but from that perspective, you know, there's a lot of our listeners who are in this stage of growth where they're done launching. Like I've kind of gotten to this place where I feel like I know my client, I feel like I know our product, but they don't know what to do next for scaling. And I know that you've got thoughts on this. I would love for you to like reflecting on what you guys did. How do you coach someone through that transition from being a launching company to a actually growth strategy company?
Well, a company to last and or a grow engine, if you want. Well, look, there's a couple of recipes you can think about over time. So if you've been successful as a market leader with a single product, there's two decisions you can take. Build a cow, build variant of this, bigger and smaller, or go international. That will carry your growth for a little bit. And then it'll stall. So if you start saying, well, what we're going to do in 3 years when we get that revenue, it forces you to think ahead, or you're going to get the second product line, or you're going to go to adjacent market, or you're going to go into a partnership level where you kind of split the pie, you build an ecosystem, and you do this. These are kind of product related ways to scale. But I could also say that what I learned typically, if you're a founder, you make it, you get IPO, it's 10 years like a mark. What will happen is a lot of the people will retire from the company.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is where it's going to hurt you. Your challenge is not the product or the go-to-market, is your process are in the head of the people.
Right.
So it's like a barn, for example, or a house. If you never do maintenance of it, it will bite you. And how many times I see it? The thing that I learned about scale is I never anticipate 5 to 10x more.
Interesting.
When everything sell or you build is 5 times faster with X growth, then everything fall apart. The system are not ready. You don't have the right people to do it.
Right.
Your legacy, you're stuck because you don't want to create revenue churn. You don't touch anything. It's almost
Yeah,
you know, that's, if I'm that's lucky, I'll retire before the problem happens, if you want.
That I totally get it. And I see people doing that.
Yeah. And look, I think one of the learning of advice, and it's easy to say it now because I'm in different space in my career.
Yeah.
I will suggest people to say, don't keep your original C-level or team no more than 7 to 10 years.
Interesting.
Because the way compensation is done largely is to eliminate risk. What you have to become is predictable to Wall Street, beat by a penny if you want.
Yep.
Don't take too much risk. Renew the portfolio every 3 years.
Totally.
And just increase the base. And that's a recipe for me of failing over time because you're going to stall. And then you decline. And if you wait too long to reinvent yourself, you exit or you get butt on the cheek.
So tell me about that because, you know, it's, I think a lot of founders have a hard time building their initial C-level team to begin with. They have a hard time kind of handing off some of those responsibilities and hiring someone smarter than them is intimidating. So there's all those factors, right? But you're talking about that next level where it's like they're a good CTO to help kind of orient your initial product. And they were a good CMO when you were working with this type of client avatar.
Yeah.
But in your case, you completely switched the avatar. And my guess is your technology changed significantly when you went to Verizon. What kind of suggestions do you give to someone who's having a hard time, A, building that first C-level team, and then B, transitioning from your founder team to a more scalable team?
Yeah, and it's funny. Like I've been in startup, and I'm investing in sometimes.
Yeah.
There's a founding member syndrome that you could see.
Yeah.
And I call it a little bit like the Lord of the Ring. The problem of the founding center is, see the ring? I'm going to pass it to you eventually. Oops, it's back to it. So the problem they get is because they have all the burden of the financial responsibility to their shareholder and investor, they're terrible to delegate. Honestly, in the first few years of a startup, hand in control is not a bad thing, because you have to say, here's our mission statement, here's our value, here's where we're going to land,
and
I will get, on behalf of everybody, us there.
Yep.
That's kind of good. But the problem is eventually, especially if your plan to exit is an IPO, an acquisition, so what are you going to do after that? You're going to live, you're going to be retired within a year because company will vest you out.
Yep, yep.
Because you're not a fit, typically, to fit in a bigger company. And then you have built no succession. And you have built no people that understand what the next phase of the company could be.
Right.
I'm telling you this because there was a time where at Cisco, 1 year, they told me, oh, we just bought this big company called WebEx. We don't really know what it is, but we're going to snap it. Software, why don't you go spend a year to integrate them?
Right.
And I remember a priceless experience. The founder, I told him, hey, I want to talk about the business plan, what we're going to do for the next 5 years. And he said, we're already done with the business plan. I said, what do you mean? You bought the company. I said, yeah, but what was the rest? It's on you now, guys. And I'm telling you that it's not far away from the mentality of a founder, which is
the mentality of the founder.
I want to hit a deal. I want it to go viral. And I want to get out because I'm not there to get the boss. I don't want to be part of a team.
Yeah. Nobody wants to get a job. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why I'm like, if you can anticipate that, and part of it will be a little bit of the critics of the VCs or the private equity. If you're invested in early stage of a company and you don't shape their leadership for the next phase, you're hurting yourself.
Right.
You should participate more in the role of coaching and guiding the phase two of the company, if not the phase three. That's one learning like that I think will make a big impact.
That's
and
awesome.
After that, it's interesting is funding club is not really about trust.
Yeah.
It's more about loyalty, if you want. And I think that they will benefit more from having Odd Apple on the team. I had better result when I had also the doctor No on my team.
Let's
say, you're wrong. You haven't thought about it. This is basic. Man, they hurt you at the beginning because you want to.
Yeah. You think you know it all already, right?
Yeah. But on the other end, if you soak on it, you test the water with few.
Right.
Sometimes we're completely right, to be honest.
So, and Michelle, when you first got your first advisors, where did you go to find them? Were they investors? Were they just people that you felt like had enough industry experience that they could coach you through it? Or what did you look for in an advisor?
Well, it's interesting. Look, like any company I've been, there's always an obligation from HR to get leadership training or coaching. So I had no shortage of coach offered to me.
Right.
Four of them. It was kind of give and take.
Totally.
I was more successful with mentor that friends will say, you know what? This is really interesting. Why don't you talk to my buddy?
Yeah.
And then we'll build a relationship because even better, if you don't know the business, you could say, well, you know, I've seen this problem, by the way, I sorted it out this way. Think about it. Mentor is a big thing in my mind. And
I agree.
And it's funny because in my early days, there used to be a time where a young engineer will not touch the code until their mentor will say they're ready to do it.
Interesting.
It was always a way to grow it by experience and learning and, you know, see how I do it. And then you can fly. That got lost over the years. And I think we need maybe to rethink a little bit about that. But my advice would be join a group of interest because I mean, you're a startup. I'm sure you're part of an industry.
Totally.
There's an interest group. There's a local group.
Yep.
They have different level of mix under established company, C-level. Just talk to them. They want to share. I mean, I'll give you an example. When you were mentioning the .com, when the .com exploded, where the revenue cycle went from 50 billion to 18 in 6 months.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, we were not the only one freaking out to say, is there still a business to make here? Everybody was kind of sharing the story. And what we find out is the customer were the one that say, guy, you need to figure out, in a way, we have to go back to the fundamental of the business, but we need, we need to talk. And if you do something,
there was a lot of crazy valuations at that point. And I think the market learned from that not to overvalue what the deliverable is. Because just being part of a .com, for a moment there, it was like, oh, they've got a cool website. Oh, they've got I'm going to throw a bunch of money at him, you know? And it was,
you're right.
Nothing was proven, and a lot of money was being spent on companies that didn't even have clients yet.
But it's funny because it used to be if you're a startup, you need to get your first customer, your advisor, right. your anchor, you get to 10, 100, and then we're going to talk if you want.
Yep.
But the .com, look, I remember we bought a company at Cisco with a PowerPoint. I was like, well, where's the product? Oh, it's coming. Well, you haven't started? Well, if you don't like it, there's like three company line up behind the door now. You can decide. We have a great team. We're going to make it. I think guns are the day, but let me challenge you on that. With AI, how much is hype versus...
It's the same thing.
Is it the tool or is it...
I see it the same way you are, and I know where you're going with that. I think that I've heard every kind of AI web service that people could come up with, and it still is like, okay, but what is your real value prop, and what are you doing differently, and who are you doing it for?
Yeah, but it's a fascinating thing because history repeat, as you know. I mean, the .com was like, if you're not going to put your business on the web, you're going to die.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Everybody has a plan for the .com.
Yeah.
You could argue everybody is forced to have an AI story of some sort. And then the debate will be in 3 years. Then you're going to have to sort out the winner and the loser.
I agree.
And go back to the fundamental of what's the value for the end customer.
Yep. Now, I see a .com boom coming in the AI space. But listen, I think that there's enough people like us around that experience that are saying, hey, this is an idea that I think is going to work because it actually has some value. And there's some level-headedness there that wasn't there during .com because it was all new. You know, people didn't even have home computers until the late 90s.
In the 80s, And look, to your point, I think there's an element to say where I'm excited about AI is I feel it can eliminate raise the productivity, eliminate the waste, give cycle for people to think versus crunching, and take the human factor of mistake out of a lot of things. But it will never replace a team motivated that can adapt, can do things. Because for me, look, AI is a little bit like a VCR. It swallows all the data of the past. It can do trends. But if it's faced to something they've never seen, the model don't adapt like that. So we'll see. But
Looking at your experience in acquisition and also being acquired and also all the elements that you've experienced, if you're talking to a young founder right now who's pretty well dialed in on their product and their service, what advice do you give them in terms of planning for exit? What's a good way to exit? Well, I'd like to end with that conversation because that is something you've done. You've been involved on both sides of it.
So
what's your best advice there?
I think the first question I ask, if somebody comes, for example, and say, hey, would you like to participate in that journey?
Yeah.
Whatever shape or form, you know, investor or fractional or full-time.
Right.
I ask the founder, what's your exit strategy? And what I really want to know is there's a difference to build a company to cash out and walk away.
Yeah.
There's a difference to say, I want to dominate an industry, be a market leader.
Right.
Because that's a different approach to
it.
It's
is.
Not just reach the first summit. You want to be in the top three on your industry.
Yep.
And it will force you to do change of portfolio, go to market or sales channel and this and that. And then I want to know, do you, especially with founder, I ask, do you want to build a company that lasts you?
Yeah.
And really few will say yes. They will say, I want to prove to people I was right. But I said, if you're right and it collapsed, disappear completely 3 years after, is that success for you, for your legacy? And I find out that you need to have a model to see what success means.
Yeah.
Young and above you. Because if you want to build company to last, you have to scale it. You have to bring the right people. You have to motivate them. You have to show that you're not going to keep the ring forever.
Right.
You're going to transition to new leadership, coaching them, advising them.
Totally.
But the one that are just there to say In-N-Out Burger.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm out. I think it's going to get harder now in that market.
That's a very interesting perspective. And with these Gen Zs turning into entrepreneurs right now, I'm seeing, I get involved in a lot of mentorship opportunities and I see a lot of people wanting that In-N-Out experience. But I also see a lot of them thinking long-term about, well, you know, I want to build a legacy program, a legacy product. And that's it's exciting to see a lot of that coming out in this next generation of innovators.
Well, it's funny you say that. I read an article just before our talk, and it kind of opened my eyes, because for me, it was always like, look, a big question I have, and I remember we making a big acquisition, and I say, look, if you work with a company, we're going to integrate you. We're going to provide you a future because we have such a holding of company. You can do whatever you want if you're good. And somebody raised his hand and I said, what's your question? I say, I don't want to be you. And I was like, well, I'm not that bad. But no, I don't want to stay in the company 5-10 years. I want to explore the world, et cetera. And it got me thinking, I was under the assumption that they're not committed to long-term passion, if you want.
Yeah. Yeah.
What I realize, a lot of them say, if I follow the current path, I'm starting this, it's going to take X year to get this and this and that. If even the company get acquired, I don't have the level of share to retire. Why don't I bypass this whole thing now that I have technology that's accessible for me to build a product plan in 3 minutes maybe?
Yeah.
So I think we're going to see from that generation things that us or the millennium were not capable to envision.
I agree.
And I think my hope is we can develop respect where the brand new can attract the middle and can attract people with a different level of experience. Because if somebody can do this, they're going to be disruptive. They're going to be changing the perception of a market, and they're going to build it for lasting and reuse people and the talent of the people.
That's a beautiful way to look at it. And I think that's a beautiful way to end the conversation, because I really feel like that is what I hope as well, is that we do see this, you know, next generation kind of looking at things in terms of, I want to make an impact, a long-term impact, and I want to kind of own this space, and I want to build something that's going to change lives. And it'll be interesting to see what evolves over the next 5-10 years. AI is changing the game.
Yeah. And that's going to be clearly an enabler. And again, I think we're here where there's a new era coming. And that's why my hope is, instead of fearing it, just embrace it. But don't kid yourself. You're still going to have to create value, a brand for yourself, a differentiation. And at the end, company don't own your career. You own the result.
Yeah.
So figure out the plan of what you want for success.
Yep. I love it. This has been a beautiful conversation. I really do appreciate your time, Michelle. And I think that for those listening, we're going to link his LinkedIn in the bio and all the things in the show notes here. But it is very interesting. Tap into mentorship. Tap into people that are willing to advise you in things that they've done before and you haven't. And understand that there are nuances to every stage of growth. Michelle, I know you've got a book coming soon, and we'll be glad to pump that as soon as you release it.
Oh, it's there.
Oh, it's there.
2 days ago. 2 days ago.
Well, what is it?
It's called Beyond the Code, Unveiling the Human Factor in Technology Leadership.
I love it. We're going to put links to that in the bio. And Michelle, thank you so much for your time today. And I really appreciate you taking the chance to get to know our audience.
Perfect. Best of luck. Bye, folks.
Thank you.
Enjoy.